Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my two dear friends, Chuck Thurston and Andre Redatus. Hi, you guys.
Hey, good morning, Paula.
Hi, Paula.
Good morning. Good morning. Yeah, Marvin is off today, so we kind of do a round robin sometimes, you know. Certain times of the year we get more busy than others, so... Marvin, I guess, is at the airport. He must be traveling somewhere. I'm not really sure of where, but safe journey, Marvin, wherever you are. And so it's the three of us today, and we are right in the middle of paper 37, Personalities of the Local Universe. And I was just reflecting about why I love this paper and how it's comforting to look at those who are directly involved with our well-being and ponder that, you know, the specifications or the specific information they give us about these marvelous celestial helpers who, you know, keep the universe running smoothly. And we can't fully appreciate how smoothly the universe runs in our isolation. But one day, we will fully appreciate it even more than we do just by reading the Urantia book, I'm sure, when we see it functioning. And I love to think about that, you know? I love to think about what that's like to see an organization that is so marvelously set up and that functions so well. I'm sure they have glitches now and then, as we know. Well, rebellion, right? But still, that these amazing personalities function so well together to make the universe run seamlessly. Pretty cool.
Yeah, they sure do. Yeah. Actually, I just came across an interesting paragraph from paper 25 that kind of explains why all these beings are brought to service out here in this, you know, the super universes of time and space. And I don't know, I think it's an interesting context for what we're going to be reading. throughout the rest of this paper. This is 25:3-7, where they say, the moment the creators bring into existence evolving individuals with the power of choice, that moment a departure is made from the smooth working of divine perfection. Misunderstandings are certain to arise, and provision for the fair adjustment of these honest differences of viewpoint must be made. We should all remember that the all-wise and all-powerful creators could have made the local universes just as perfect as Havana. No conciliating commissions need function in the central universe, but the creators did not choose in their all-wisdom to do this. And while they have produced universes which abound in differences and teem with difficulties, they have likewise provided the mechanisms and the means for composing all these differences and for harmonizing all this seeming confusion.
Hmm.
I mean, it's sort of what you're talking about there, Paula.
So, well, that's what you want to see, how they work that out. You know,
right,
I want
right,
to
right.
see that in action. I want, because it's not apparent on our world. It doesn't happen on our world very often, where we achieve, you know, that balance or working that, you know. But I know they see that we will. Yeah.
Yeah,
that we can harmonize.
Differences in viewpoint. I mean, that's interesting.
Honest. Honest differences.
Yeah.
I think that's the key right there. They're honest.
Yeah, and then let alone dishonest differences.
Right. If they're dishonest, that's another matter. I mean, you know, how do they deal with that?
Yeah.
But honest differences, yeah, that would almost be easier, much easier to deal with.
You would think.
You know, yeah.
But as we all know, even honest differences can get pretty heated sometimes.
Can get pretty heated, yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, even in our own affairs.
Well, the idea is that
right
an
thing.
Honest difference
yeah.
might actually lead somewhere productive. You might actually get somewhere with people with honest differences.
Right.
I mean, think about how many times your opinion has been changed because somebody presented a point of view, a sincere point of view,
mm-hmm.
that was,
mm-hmm.
you know, a legitimately different way of seeing that you hadn't considered. And all of a sudden now you have a new way of approach. Well, that's one thing. It's a completely different thing when somebody is disingenuous, is simply arguing for a position that benefits, you know, a small minority,
right.
and is making their arguments on that basis and is insincere, knows that it would
mm-hmm.
be better to do something,
mm-hmm.
but argues for the other case because the interests that they represent are they want that. And
mm-hmm.
my goodness, we are rife with that on this world. Rife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can't get away from it.
Well, it's a lower motivation.
The guiding principle probably for these universe commissions and others who work out these differences is the, you know, they have their eye on the good of the whole. And when that's lost, and a lot doesn't even occur to, like down here on the level of human affairs, it doesn't even occur to a lot of people that maybe they should be voluntarily looking out for the good of the whole through their deliberations and, you know, putting forward proposals and viewpoints. Because like you're saying, Andre, when it devolves to just being self-interest to a limited group, or even an individual, then you lose that connection, you know, that part in the whole ethic, you might say, the ethos.
The classic example of that on this world is the Sanhedrin, right? And their own narrow interest concerned Jesus of Nazareth.
Mm.
And Jesus, logically, if they had looked at him with an open mind and an open heart, would have seen that he posed no threat to them, none.
Hmm.
But their fear of him was based on his influence. And
mm-hmm.
because he was, you know, such a charming, magnetic personality, they could see that he had the power to influence many people. And so he became a threat to them, but because of his honest viewpoint, you know. But theirs was not honest. Theirs was more based on self-interest. Theirs was based on staying in power, and their fear of him is what caused them to seek his destruction. But it was needless. It was baseless fear. And oftentimes what, you know, humans engage in is exactly that. It's baseless, unfounded, irrational fear. You know, it's like the Urantia book says, a master intellectual fraud. We allow ourselves to be just, you know, overtaken by it. And the more we engage in thinking about what makes us afraid, the more real it becomes, and the more desperate we become to eliminate that thing that we fear. And it's just interesting. It's an interesting dynamic that works against humanity, especially without the guidance, the wisdom of these ancient beings who have so much experience, you know, which they're the ones guiding the universe, right? And
well,
they can see
Jesus,
past any of these. Go ahead, Chuck.
Jesus clearing the money changers and stuff out of the temple court, that did not endear him to the authorities.
No, but at that point, you know, I think he realized.
I mean, he was a threat.
He might as well.
Or they perceived him as a threat to their economic enterprise.
Well, right.
Yeah.
But they were already, by then, they were already pretty well, they already had the intention of doing away with him. That's the thing.
Well,
they had
true.
Already met in council many, many times to discuss this problem of Jesus. And he even said, you know, why do you fear me? I pose no threat to you. I mean, we just read about that last week, didn't we, Andre, where he's kind of, again, appealing to them, saying, you know, you don't have to do this. But they were already pretty well set on doing it before he ever cleared the temple. So maybe he used that as, that was his, like, that and his last temple discourse was him calling them out. Because they were already set on doing what they had in mind to do. But, yeah, these conciliators and these beings that serve and work in the universe, they really help, I think, help us avoid a lot of those pitfalls that you described in that section you read, Chuck. I think
well,
a lot of those pitfalls can be
to,
avoided.
Yeah, they'll come to actually listen to both sides and ameliorate some of those differences in order for things to move forward smoothly. What's interesting is that the divine executioner that is part of that conciliation quartet, you know, has power to enforce the decision. And not only power to enforce, it's clear that in that society that we will, you know, be waking into, that, you know, once we get used to it, we all accept that as the better way to accomplish things, actually hear each other out, come to an agreement. And more as we go up further and further, we ameliorate these things ourselves. We'll find out that these conciliating commissions function more and more as fact finders and observers and whatnot at the higher and higher levels, because at the higher levels, more and more, we solve our own problems. We come to our own solutions to those problems, and we do it acceptably. Not only acceptably, we do it well. We begin to do it so well that eventually we're accepted into Havona, where we never will cause a problem. I mean, that's what's really kind of astounding here, trying to imagine from our current estate rising up, getting better, becoming so disciplined, so purposeful, so loving, so broad in perspective that we will never, ever, ever, ever cause a problem again for somebody else.
Mm. Mm.
Just that one aspect.
Yeah, we'll see about
just that.
That
negative. No, uh-huh. We won't. We won't. Or we wouldn't be allowed into Havona. If you cause problems, you don't get into Havona. If you still,
well,
if you still
mean,
have
like problems, yeah.
Those
you
elements.
You cause problems deliberately, yeah.
No, there's no such thing as a problem in Havona that doesn't get dealt
well, right.
with
yeah.
harmoniously.
Right, right.
Disharmony never appears in Havona, and that can't happen unless everybody is functioning on a very, very high level. Evidently, a third stage spirit functions at least that high a level. Even though we're not perfect yet, we're good enough for Havona at that point. We have perfection of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a big part of it.
Last night I took my grandson, Max, who's 7, to the symphony to see Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton's classic film, Nightmare Before Christmas, and the symphony played the score, the entire score live.
Oh, lovely.
And,
that's a fun.
My attempt, it was fabulous. It was wonderful. I went on a date with one of my best boyfriends in the whole world, my little grandson. He's, oh, my God. I mean, you know, you love your children and grandchildren. What can you say? It just is beyond words how much you love your children and grandchildren. But I was trying to explain to him on the way down the beauty of a symphony orchestra. And while we were sitting there watching them sit down and tune up their instruments and get ready, you know, before the conductor comes out, before the show actually starts, and I'm trying to explain to him there, Max, you see, there's the brass section and all the horns, and there's the violins and the strings, and there's the percussion over there, and pretty soon the conductor will come out and he'll lead them, and they'll all, even though they're all different musicians, and they all have come from different backgrounds, and they've all practiced their instrument to where they're perfect at it almost. But even then, they still can't play together, but he will come out and conduct them, and they'll all play beautifully together. They'll play so beautifully. And it's like that, I think. What you're talking about, Andre, is like that, where, you know, we get to a point where we've mastered ourselves, our instrument or whatever. That's like a little microcosm of that concept where they've mastered their own abilities. And then the conductor comes out and he's able to bring them together in this most amazing, joyful music harmony. And it's you know, a good symphony is flawless. And you think what it takes for them to do that is just wonderful. It just shows that we can do it. And the thing that they all have in common is the love of music. And it's their love that brings them together, their love of music. And so they, you know, and that must be the skill that we really hone, I think, as we go through the universe and universes. We hone our love to a degree, just as you were saying, you know, it becomes so broad and so inclusive and so far-seeing and accepting and honoring.
Mm.
Uh-huh. Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, I was just going to say, the thing is going to be so interesting about our Havona career. I mean, if I can speak about that with any great knowledge. But there's going to be a collaboration between achieved perfection and created perfection. You know, and they talk about that we'll represent achieved perfection as we work with the Havona natives who are represent created perfection, right? So that's a complemental dynamic that will then produce super additive outcomes. You know, we've talked about that a lot, you know, always looking for potentials for super additive outcomes. comes from a difference. You know, there's a gulf. You know, they talk about how the Avona natives don't really comprehend our experience of what we've had to go through to become who we are when we arrive on the shores of Avona. I mean, they can observe it and understand it intellectually, but they don't have the experiential knowledge of what, you know, we will have gone through to get there. So that does create a kind of a gulf, but it's a creative gulf. So it's not to say there won't be, you know, differences. You know, it's very going to be, I think, a very important difference. It creates a very dynamic engagement that then, of course, produces super additive outcomes. Some outcomes that neither an ascending being or a Havana native could achieve acting separately. It requires a combined partnership. And, you know, I think we see the same pattern in a lot of instances throughout the universe. It's like even with Michael and the Mother Spirit, you know, there's a complemental difference there, or human gender, same thing. And those complemental differences, at least on the human level, can often be stressful. And, you know, they talk about the personality gulf between men and women. We have to work that out somehow. But working it out produces all kinds of good outcomes. So I don't know what it's going to be like on Havona, but and I'm sure it'll all get worked out harmoniously. But still, there is going to be that kind of a reaching across, a gulf of difference to engage in creative, collaborative.
And the key to that is a willingness, right? Just a willingness.
And a desire
to entertain. Yeah, willingness and desire and that mutual love, just like the orchestra. You know, I may not be able to see your point of view entirely, but I love you and I'm willing, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm willing to hear you out, or I'm willing to work with you in order that we might play together, right? Or
and learn.
Learn from each other. Help each other find the, you know, the sweet spot, the balance that we're looking for, the harmony that we're trying to achieve,
and that takes a great deal of willingness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and have that higher goal that you can bring into focus, like you're saying, with an orchestra, everybody's going for the good of the whole, that enterprise.
Right.
You know, you don't have a trumpet player running off by himself playing something that's not on the score. You know. It's like everybody's paying attention to the conductor. Everybody's got their part to play in creating this wonderful whole. And the satisfaction of that is it's a wonderful and beautiful thing.
Wouldn't you say it's supremely satisfying?
About that, Paul. What's that?
Wouldn't you say that's supremely satisfying? That's one of the greatest satisfactions.
Right, in the true sense of supreme. Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you were talking about that, describing that, it made me think of the Lucifer Manifesto, which promotes the exact opposite, which is unbridled self-assertion, which is it's all about me.
True.
You know.
So who needs the orchestra? I'll just stand up here and play by myself all day.
Exactly. I mean, it really is a sabotage of the principle of working for the greater good.
I never saw it quite so clearly before,
but that's part of the problem with rebellion, is it completely disrupts.
That's what selfishness does. Selfishness sabotages harmony. It sabotages, what we can create together. And each one of us has a part. But if we're going to be selfish, we're going to sabotage that beautiful end result. That, you know, I've never had the blessing of playing an instrument that well, and being able to. I admire musicians so much. I just admire their skill, and I admire that they can get up there and do that and read that music and play. You know, it's sublime that they can do that. I have sung in a choir, and I've achieved that same feeling, though. When you reach that harmonic, when you're singing in a choir and all of a sudden everybody's singing their part, whether it's alto or, you know, bass or whatever their part is, soprano, and you achieve that harmonic and it's like, oh, yes, that's it. And it makes you feel so good. It is supremely satisfying. And so that must be what the whole universe experiences when they can bring a world like ours along, you know, and get us to sing as part of the great choir, or, you know, to play as one of the finely tuned instruments in the universe, and the harmonic that results from that.
Your description of worship on paradise, you're reminding me of those descriptions of worship on paradise, where
the
all
rapture.
The beings, you get to use the best they know, you know, as a creative contribution to that. And it's, you know, I don't know.
Wow.
Sure you remember the language around that.
I do remember that they have to stop them.
Right.
Because they get carried away. They're enjoying it so much.
Uh-huh.
It's like, okay, we got to get back to work or something, you know. It's so sublime. It's so thrilling.
The heart of God has been satisfied. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Isadora points out, harmony is the speech of Havona. Yes. I think of that quote a lot, Isadora, because... you know, that when we achieve harmony on this world, that's what's so satisfying about it. I think we're speaking the language of the universe. And in another place, doesn't it say music is the universal language of men, spirits, and angels, or something like that?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thanks for letting me wax philosophical, you guys. That was an amazing date that I had with my little buddy.
That's so cool.
Well, that was wonderful. Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, do you want to read forward on Most High Assistance? And we can go back and look at some of that other stuff on the Archangels if you want to do that. But did you want to read, since we haven't heard you read in a little bit?
Oh, sure, I can read. Let's see. We are on Most High Assistance. Yes, I would be happy to do that. And we're doing pretty
great.
Good with time, so yay.
Yeah.
So here is Section 4, and we can reflect back to Archangels, too. There were some things I wanted to mention about that. But we'll go on with Section 4, Most High Assistance. And this is from Paper 37, Personalities of the Local Universe. The Most High Assistants are a group of volunteering beings of origin outside the local universe who are temporarily assigned as central and super universe representatives to or observers of the local creations. Their number varies constantly, but is always far up in the millions. From time to time, we thus benefit from the ministry and assistance of such paradise origin beings as perfectors of wisdom, divine counselors, universal censors, inspired Trinity spirits, Trinitized sons, solitary messengers, supernaphim, seconaphim, tertiaphim, and other gracious ministers who sojourn with us for the purpose of helping our native personalities in the effort to bring all Nebadon into fuller harmony with the ideas of Orvantan and the ideals of paradise. Any of these beings may be voluntarily serving in Nebadon and hence be technically outside our jurisdiction. But when functioning by assignment, such personalities of the super and central universes are not wholly exempt from the regulations of the local universe of their sojourn. Though they continue to function as representatives of the higher universes and to work in accordance with the instructions which constitute their mission in our realm, their general headquarters is situated in the Salvington sector of the Union of Days, and they operate in Nebadon subject to the over supervision of this ambassador of the Paradise Trinity. When serving in unattached groups, these personalities from the higher realms are usually self-directing. But when serving on request, they often voluntarily place themselves wholly under the jurisdiction of the supervising directors of the realms of assigned function. Most High Assistants serve in local universe and in constellation capacities, but are not directly attached to the system or planetary governments. They may, however, function anywhere in the local universe and may be assigned to any phase of Nebadon activity, administrative, executive, educational, and others. Most of this core is enlisted in assisting the Nebadon Paradise personalities, the Unions of Days, the Creator's Son, the Faithfuls of Days, the Magisterial Sons, and the Trinity Teacher Sons. Now and then, in the transaction of the affairs of a local creation, it becomes wise to withhold certain details temporarily from the knowledge of practically all of the native personalities of that local universe. Certain advanced plans and complex rulings are also better grasped and more fully understood by the more mature and far-seeing core of the Most High Assistants. And it is in such situations and many others that they are so highly serviceable to the universe rulers and administrators. You know, I got to say what this, what occurs to me when I read this is these are our revelators. And they came here on assignment. And they were, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, they really fit this description, don't you think? They really fit this
they
description
were most
of being called.
Many of them, absolutely.
Yeah.
Divine counselors, perfectors of wisdom, universal censors, solitary messengers, Supernifim, Sakonifim, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And they came to our universe, subject to Michael of this universe, you know, our Michael. And they presented this amazing revelation of truth to us. And so they acted as educators in this instance. Interesting. It really explains so well what was going on there, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Grateful to
well,
them.
They included educational in that list,
right.
Of how they serve. Yeah, it's pretty clear.
Yeah. Yeah, they voluntarily
came. Interesting comment about withholding. Certain details temporarily. I mean,
so
I can understand the wisdom of that. What's that?
Well, it's really interesting to get a flavor for what some of that might be, because you know we're getting this revelation. We're being told about all of these things that happened, for instance, with regard to the bestowals, and it's fascinating stuff that they're telling us, right? They're telling us, you know, how Michael made certain decisions and was coming here or whatever. But there is a particular line. I'm going to quickly try to find it here. And it had to do with before he had made certain decisions about bestowal or I'm going to just get there. I think it's going to be here. It's possibly in paper 119, but yeah. Well, so for one thing, for tens of thousands of years, we all looked forward to the seventh and final bestowal. This is section 7 in paper 119. Of Michael, Gabriel had taught us that the terminal bestowal would be made in the likeness of mortal flesh. But we were wholly ignorant of the time, place, and manner of this culminating adventure. The public announcement that Michael had selected Urantia as the theater for his final bestowal was made shortly after we learned about the default of Adam and Eve. And thus, for more than 35,000 years, your world occupied a very conspicuous place in the councils of the entire universe. There was no secrecy, aside from the incarnation mystery, connected with any step in the Arantia bestowal. From first to last, up to the final triumphant return of Michael to Salvington as supreme universe sovereign, there was the fullest universe publicity of all that transpired on your small but highly honored world. While we believed that this would be the method, we never knew until the time of the event itself that Michael would appear on Earth as a helpless infant of the realm.
Wow.
Theretofore,
they didn't know that.
He always appeared. They didn't know that. How do you not know that?
How do you not know that?
There's 611,120 other creator sons, not all of whom have had bestowals, obviously, yet, but many had in other local universes. So what does that say? To me, it says that there is great sequestration. Yes, there are things that are revealed that are brought in from other local universes and super universes. There are things that are shared by those that come in, but there are many things that probably are not shared.
Mm.
And it says something about the level of not secrecy, but the idea of closed-mouthedness as it is necessary, something that unfortunately most human beings don't know.
Right.
Most human beings are gossips, and if they know something that others don't know, would prefer to divulge it than to keep it secret, even if they've been asked to keep it a secret. Now, that's obviously not universally true, or we would be in big trouble, you know, but it is an interesting feature of life there. Is it possible that they in the local universe really didn't know that he would be born as an infant? And what does that mean about the bestowals of individuals? It says they're always born of women, right? It says that elsewhere. They're always born of
models, too.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah.
They always are. They never just show up full, like Melchizedek did, right? A full-fledged being in adult stature.
So if that's the case, how is it that it is not known? How?
How do they keep that a secret?
Yeah, it really either stretches credulity on the one hand, or it says something quite remarkable about the amount of sequestration and closed-mouthedness there is about what happens elsewhere. And it wasn't assumed that Creator Son would do it the way the Avenals did it, at least, because there are plenty of Avenal bestowals in the local universe that they could look at. That's a good point that you made, Paula. You know, but wow. Yeah.
Huh.
I mean,
so
I mean, they make this point in our paper in 22.7, three bestowal missions. The Avonal sons do all at least once bestow themselves upon some mortal race on some evolutionary world. Judicial visits are numerous. Magisterial missions may be plural. But on each planet, there appears but one bestowal son. Dole Avonals are born of woman, as Michael of Nebadon was incarnated on Urantia. Well, again, if that's known, if that's seen, and it's certainly not hidden, because nothing about the Urantia bestowal was hidden either, but how is it that until that time, it was not known, unless there is this element of certain things that have not occurred yet are not fully revealed.
Well, there may be a clue to the wisdom of that. Oh, go ahead, Paul.
Well, I just wanted to point out that that particular bestowal happens only once in the history of our universe, right?
Yeah.
It only
right.
happens once. Those other bestowals happen a lot, but that one happens only once. So it wouldn't be so difficult to keep the details of those particular bestowals that happen only once in the history of the universe under wraps, you know, maybe. You know, that is not divulged. That the particular details of that bestowal of the Creator Son in his local universe, whichever one it is, has not been divulged to other universes. So they really didn't know for sure. They might speculate. We know they speculate all the time. But maybe they just didn't know for sure that that's how it was going to come down. And as that relates to the Most High assistants, you know, they kind of tell us this is where they come in so handy. Is that those advanced plans and complex rulings are also better grasped and more fully understood by the more mature and far-seeing core of Most High assistants. And it is in such situations and many others that they are so highly serviceable. They're like the intelligence corps or the, you know, I mean, we see this on our world where these people, you know, why you would get a security clearance, why that's even necessary, you know. Mm-hmm. It's necessary even here that not everything is divulged. And I always marvel, you know, at Jesus. He traveled for what, 2 years and his family didn't know where he was? They knew nothing?
Yeah.
And you think, okay, that's kind of, I don't know, if I was Jesus' family, I'd think, wow, does he not love us anymore? He's not communicating with us at all. You know, and mm-hmm. and there's a whole year, right, where I think there's a whole year that the papers don't tell us anything about in his life. And you think, wow, what was mm-hmm. he doing in that year? I'm curious to know. But they withheld us for whatever reason. Who knows why? Mm-hmm. So we don't mm-hmm. really know. But it's not dishonesty to do that. It's not dishonest to withhold information.
Mm.
You know, and I think that's important to remember, to keep a secret, to keep a trust. You know, we often think of secretiveness and secrets as being a bad thing, but they're not necessarily. They can be a very wise and necessary thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of a lesson from Jesus in one of my favorite books is God Calling. You guys know this because I've said it before, but one of the lessons was, in one of the lessons he says, don't be anxious about the future. I have mercifully withheld that from you. And I think, wow, yeah, you know, I don't want to know.
there are certain things we probably don't want to know about where our world is going and
in
about
some
various
ways,
other
it
things.
Is merciful to withhold that because if you knew all the trouble that's coming, it would rob every moment of joy in your life, right? Even if most of your life is joy and only one thing is troublesome. What?
Imagine Mary knowing that Jesus was off to Rome.
Yeah, right.
Okay? Imagine those 2 years for Mary. Just on that one thing alone. Do you suppose she might have had that on her mind for all every day of 2 years? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Mary being who Mary was. Yeah.
Sure. It would have just troubled her greatly. He mercifully withheld that.
I'm not saying that that's the only reason, but that would be reason enough. That one thing would have been reason enough not to disclose that. In any case, I mean, it isn't conversely true that to have a secret isn't deceitful. It can be, you know, especially with intention or whatever, but you make the good point that secrets in and of themselves are not bad. They're actually necessary in certain cases. I mean, they're clearly necessary all the way up. We're told
right.
about the Trinitized secrets of supremacy on each of the worlds of the Father. And those secrets are effectively eternal secrets that are withheld forever, as far as we know. We don't know of any point in eternity where those secrets will be disclosed. But they are withheld, and they're withheld from high spiritual beings, even beings that transcend the finite, don't know all of those secrets. That's very, very interesting that the universe functions in that way. And imagine the infinity that God knows. He knows and sees the entire unfolding of it all. He sees the end from the beginning. Well, for one thing, you can't disclose infinity and eternity to beings that can't grasp the fullness of it in any event. But the other side of it is wisdom declares not to disclose all of it. And that's hard to imagine. Though people that have grown up in wartime or under persecution or understand some things have some very different views of what it takes sometimes to navigate adverse situations and what was necessary to do in order to navigate those situations. There are things that under normal times may appear positively immoral, maybe even appear sinful, that during these times
was commonplace.
May be entirely necessary. Yeah,
right.
I can't imagine
some
of the decisions that people in the Ukraine are having to make right now, you know, on the basis of survival and preserving their country. Or think about the people that are undergoing the famines in Ethiopia and Kenya and Somalia right now. I mean, these are things that are happening on our world at this moment. And people are having to make decisions, or women that are having to safeguard themselves and having to try to educate, their younger sisters, the girls of their nation in Afghanistan. All of these things are, imagine the subterfuge that has to be employed in order to get some of these things across under such persecution, or in Iran right now.
And then imagine all of that under, and Isadora brought this up on the board as well, under the reality that there's a rebellion going on and you have enemies out there who secretly want to foil every good plan you have, every good thing you want to do,
I wanted to point out something along those lines, if I could just interject for a second.
Sure.
In terms of this secrecy around Michael's the Stole, I mean, they knew it was going to happen and where, but the details weren't fully made known. And part of the reason for that, I think, is in the next paragraph in that same section where, Andre, you were reading, where they say that all intelligence has realized that the last the Stole was in progress. And as we had long known of the Lucifer Rebellion in Satania, in the Caligastia disaffection on Urantia, we well understood the intensity of the struggle which would ensue when our ruler condescended to incarnate on Urantia in the humble form and likeness of mortal flesh.
So some
of that secrecy may have been intended so that Caligastia would have, he definitely, I think, he laid plans to disrupt the Stole, even as it was, but didn't know exactly. He could guess, but didn't know the exact circumstances, and that probably provided some protection. Although, as we know, even in the very beginning, Joseph and Mary had to flee
right
with the baby Jesus to avoid being killed by Herod. because of some, you know, unwise.
We also know lots of little babies were killed.
Right, exactly.
In an effort,
in that very effort. Yeah. Yeah, so you got to assume that Caligasti was somehow probably behind that, even though the spilling of the beans was well-intended, you know, by, what was her name, Anna and her, and Zacharias.
Mm-hmm.
He was
mm-hmm.
the one who really spilled the beans. But that was mm-hmm. really not wise for them to sing that song, that poem, the phrase, even though it probably seemed like a wonderful celebration, given what they knew, that immediately clued in Herod and set him off on this course to kill all the boy babies. So those
right.
kind of things go on. Yeah,
it just goes to show, too, how unwittingly, to your point earlier, Andre, about we get into Havana and we're no longer a problem. You know, we can so easily become a huge problem unwittingly. We don't mean to do any harm. You know, we have
mm-hmm.
the best of intentions. We're just acting out of a place of, like you said, Chuck, joy, to sing a song in celebration of something that's special. And suddenly we've, you know, that's the hardest part about life on your ranch, is what you do unwittingly, right? For me, it's like, wow, Father, please, you know, keep me from doing any damage. You know,
like sir,
I pray that a lot. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can so easily fall into the trap of our own humanness, and just because we're not far-seeing, right? I think that's the thing that's most lacking on this world, in my opinion, is that ability to be far-seeing, to look forward and see the consequences of actions down the road. We don't have that ability. And so we fall into these traps. And the only way we Urantians can learn these lessons is experientially, if we're open to learning them, you know, in the first place. I mean, we thwart our own growth so often, but we just don't seem to have that ability and that wisdom. Of course, that comes with experience, and nothing would be better than to have the wisdom of Adam and Eve directly available to us, or even the wisdom of a loyal planetary prince. But we just don't have those things, and therefore seeing ability we don't have. So we just have to pretty much fumble our way on down the road of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough. It's tough sledding. This is it's like Mo likes to say, it's a tough neighborhood we're in down here on this planet. Most often we learn everything the hard way, if we learn it at all.
Yes, we
do. Know? And thank God for revelations, right? That's why we celebrate it. And I think even now, you know, we've agonized over oftentimes, and I've been involved with the movement since 77, and we agonize if we're doing the right thing. Are we doing the right thing by doing this broadcast? Are we doing the right thing by sharing this information broadly? You know, we've agonized over these things in the past. And, you know, you can reason, well, how it could be the harm of sharing this revelation. It's such a beautiful revelation. Well, someone can take it and twist it and pervert it and make it sound like an ugly, evil thing, too. And to have.
Well, I'm going to remind
Paula,
to look at your calendar, by the way, since, just as an aside, by my count, the Cosmic Citizen has been at this for at least 14 years, and we may be coming up to the 15th anniversary, and you were there with the originals, with Crystalline and Andre Traversa and, you know, whoever else was there at the beginning. I was checking that out because I wanted to see when I came onto the program, and I know I came onto the program sometime in 2012 while I was in Quebec. I actually subbed for you in March. I subbed for you in March, and then I came on in the summer. as a regular co-host. But, you know, you think about something like that. In the beginning, you go and you plunge in. You don't know whether you're doing the right thing. It hasn't been done before. We have a slow growth policy. You know, this is what a number of newer students of the Urantia book won't realize, is that there were people that it was almost like a dogma, the slow growth policy. You dare not, you know, advertise, do anything else. I mean, if you put a little thing in the newspaper that you have a Urantia study group, that was sort of like, put it in the personal ads. Don't do anything, you know, too big.
Overt.
Or anything like that.
Yeah.
Overt.
Right.
You know, and you will remember, you know, because we were both there. We were both there at the first Urantia book booth that ever was done in Colorado and in the world that we know of.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, a big stretch. It was like we decided it was the right thing to do, but everything we had heard, and especially from the official organizations up to that point, said, oh, you shouldn't do that. We're trying to let this grow slowly. Don't be out there. Don't be putting things out there. Now, you think about that in hindsight. That was in 1983 or thereabouts, 83, 84, maybe 82. Think about that. This is now something that's part of how the Urantia book is disseminated. We have book fairs all over the world. This is a large part of what my Latin American subcommittee under the International Fellowship Committee, what many of the area coordinator field workers are doing, whether it be in Mexico or in Chile or Bolivia or Argentina or wherever a book fair is held, Ecuador. That's all of these places have been promulgating El Libro de Urantia and the Urantia book. And it's now nobody thinks, should we do it?
Right.
It's done. You know,
I guess that's what it means to blaze the trail.
At the beginning, nobody knew. Right.
Right. Nobody knew. And, you know, and some of the things that they said to oppose it were pretty insulting. And, you know, but I think the basic question for me always was, look, you know, we're in a marketplace of ideas here. Does it deserve to have its place in that market of ideas? Or should it be kept a secret? And, you know, my answer was no. It belongs in this marketplace of ideas. It's leaven. It needs to be there. It needs to be known. But others would be just as passionate that it needed to be kept a secret.
Sure.
And, of course, then with the advent of the Internet, how could you possibly – there's no way to keep anything a secret anymore. You know,
no, it's online.
It seems – yeah, it's all
anybody
online.
Anybody can read it.
And
nobody has to even pay anything for it. It's all there for you. It's free.
Well,
so,
Andre, it's like my dreams came true. And yours did too, and yours too, Chuck. I mean,
yours and
that
many
was my
others.
Dream.
Yeah.
That anybody could have it and access it and, you know, be able to benefit from it. And that's an interesting example. And, you know, I just want to point out that when we first did do that and decided to do that public outreach back in 1983, the foundation sent out two of their top ambassadors to try to talk us out of it. And they couldn't. We were so adamant that the time had come to share this information. And
In fairness, there clearly are problems with the promulgation of the Urantia teachings.
Yeah.
You know, some of those problems, you know, recently came to light with a blogger who had a very negative, you may have seen it, take on the Urantia book and named some some of the principals in your Rancher Foundation and what they were involved in, and you know, and the fact is that those kinds of things are going to happen, and there does have to be some kind of judicious handling of all of that. The thing we've learned is it's not black and white, and we have to learn how to navigate those things, how to understand the gray zone, understand which way you go when there is both good and potential evil to be realized, you know, in undertaking any kind of an action. But it doesn't mean you do nothing.
Right. Well, no easy thing we've chosen to do here. And yet, you know, I still ultimately feel really good about it. Always.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime we tell people about the Urantia book, I feel good about it. And I always encourage them to just read the whole thing because it's going to answer any questions they have, you know. But these people, these detractors who take things out of context and use them, it's pretty nefarious, if you ask me. They just want to make a name for themselves, you know. They found the next new cult that they're going to expose or whatever is their motive, but they haven't really bothered to take the work in as a whole and understand, you know, the point of view of the revelators and what they might be saying, or the authors, let's just say the authors, whoever they are, you know. I always find it easy or interesting when people criticize so vehemently something they have no experience with. You know, I just find that amazing. How do they think that's fair? But they do, because they have some other motive in mind. You know, it's either making a name for themselves or whatever it is, whatever their motive is, you know, or as we know with the rebellion, just to completely obfuscate any counter notion, you know, and the universe didn't do that. The universe allowed them full, and still does, really, allowed them to fully promote whatever it was they were thinking. Yeah. Although in isolating us, they didn't allow it to spread irrationally, you know, or uncontrolled. They controlled it for sure. They controlled the spread of these poisonous ideas through quarantine and isolation. So that's another part of it. That's interesting too.
And well, it's especially interesting these days, isn't it, in the age of quote-unquote fake news and all of the kinds of things that we're wrestling with, you know, and it doesn't matter which side of the issue you're on that. The fact is that we're in the age of disinformation, and we're seeing what happens when there is no quarantine internally, when in fact freedom of speech doesn't have the commensurate wisdom and character of its citizenry behind it. When you have freedom of speech and you don't have a citizenry that has the character to handle freedom of speech, it is not an unmitigated good. It doesn't mean you take freedom of speech away, but it does mean you better get responsible about how you train your citizenry on what it is responsible to say. What is public speech? What is fair to say? And what is irresponsible to say? And when, in fact, you can have politicians attacked, which has happened recently, when you can have politicians attacked, and it has happened in the last 10 years on both sides of the aisle that politicians have been attacked, you have to wonder at the function of free speech and clandestine speech and all of it that actually foments that. You know, in the Urantia book, you know, bringing it back to our study here, there are these lessons in how things are conducted even at higher levels. And when they say it's important, sometimes to withhold certain details in certain complex rulings. What do you mean in certain complex rulings? Well, in complex rulings that people aren't going to understand right away until they can, you know, get to understand them, until they can study them and learn about them. I mean, you can imagine that some of the rulings at the higher levels require the best Marantia minds and the best spiritual minds to be able to interpret them and then teach them to the citizenry so that they understand why are the higher-ups doing it this way? It isn't a matter of just blind faith up there. It's got to be a matter of informed faith that allows things to work. Wise faith.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a thing that's been elusive. And I what you were saying just took me back to the interregnum quote, which we've read many times on the show. I don't know that I need to read it again, but just, yeah, well, and it says for when culture advances over fast, when material achievement outruns the evolution of worship wisdom, Chuck likes to point those two words out together, worship-wisdom, then does civilization contain within itself the seeds of retrogression? And unless buttressed by the swift augmentation of experiential wisdom, such human societies will recede from high but premature levels of attainment. You know, the internet is just exactly, to me, this is exactly one of those instances where what you were just saying, where we really need to bring our best wisdom to bear on how to manage this thing, because the potentials are huge and we can see it. We see it happening right in front of our eyes, how, you know, people can, you know, how certain ideas, hateful ideas, even insidious, I mean, they're coercive, they're corrosive. I think that's the most thing that happens is they're corrosive. Because why are they corrosive? Because they plant such doubt and fear, and people don't know what to believe anymore. And so, you know, the internet is clearly one of these things that, to me, is a material achievement that has outrun our evolution of worship wisdom. And you know, what we communicate then on those platforms matters more than ever than anything, because it takes the best of our thinking to be able to and to assume that nobody out there is able to be influenced by what we're saying is absurd. Of course they are. I mean, my children and I have had this conversation many, many times about the danger and detriment to violence in movies and video games. I'll just throw that one out there.
Sure.
This is another way that we communicate, and it's a very powerful way. I don't think we fully understand how powerful the visual medium is, movies, and we just don't. We do. We understand it because advertisers certainly do understand it. They fully understand it, right?
Oh, yeah.
But don't understand the potential damage it can do to people who are very susceptible to the planting of a suggestion. And not everybody is able to say, well, this is just fantasy, this is just a movie, and well, this is just a video game. It's, you know, it's fantasy, it's not real. Some people, you know, are very susceptible to suggestions of violence or suggestions of, you know, of that nature. And we need to take that into account, because what we see, a lot of the violence we see in our society is due to that. They say that some of these video games are more violent than an actual military simulator, and more exacting in terms of the training that a young person gets on how to just go and shoot up everything, you know. Mm-hmm. Just from, you know, some of these violent video games. And I know it doesn't have that effect on everybody, but to think that it doesn't have that effect on anybody, to me, is unwise and foolish. And just because money can be made on it doesn't mean it's right, too. Yeah, clearly not
clearly
true.
Clearly not
so,
true. Yeah.
That's just an example. I know we've really gone down a rabbit hole here with this.
Well, not really. Not really. It fits with what we were talking about. I'm just wondering if there's anything else we want to plumb out of this, or whether there was anything else that you had from Section 3. If you haven't had a chance to look at it yet, that's fine. Why don't we go through and read 5, the High Commissioners, unless, Chuck, you have something else to say about Section 4. And then if you could have a glance at 3 and see if there was something in the Archangels that you didn't get to say last week because you weren't here, because that was fascinating. It was a fascinating discussion. I'm always amazed at the personality record keepers that work with the Archangels. It's just fascinating. I could go on and on, and there's
well,
so many
I just
things.
Have
and, of course.
One question for you guys about that, because I know that's the term student visitors comes up several times in the Urantia book. And in fact, a lot of Urantia book readers are always fascinated with student visitors. And, oh, heck, there's probably lots of them here right now, you know. And who are they, do you think? I mean, it talks about these student visitors who suddenly we've drawn their attention. And we've become this sphere of great attention to them, and even more so because now there's an Archangel circuit or headquarters here on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fascinated by the fact that Michael made a bestowal here, and all of a sudden they call us this, you know, obscure little planet, and suddenly we're this focus of attention. And then Chuck mentioned earlier how for all those years, because Michael chose this world, we were the focus of the universe's attention as well. You know, who are these student visitors, do you think? Are they, would you say that some of the ETs we talk about could be student visitors? Do they come here physically? Are they always celestial? Are they not,
well, that
could
narrows
they not
it,
be
that
material?
Narrows it down quite a bit. Yeah. Chuck, I think you wanted to speak first. Did I hear you speaking?
No, just listening along.
Okay, and then what I'll say is, clearly there are student visitors, I think, from the Urantia world. That's the low-hanging fruit, okay? The student visitors that are coming here from within the local universe that are fellow ascenders from other places, just like we will be student visitors going on excursions and field trips to other planets. You know, count the number of planets that you're fascinating in wanting to go visit right now. The neighboring planets, I want to go visit.
The non-breathers.
I want to go visit.
Yeah. Right.
Besides that, the non-breather world is probably going to be the one that gets us closest to Urantia. It's probably in this solar system, in my opinion. But in any event, the Midsoniter world, you know, all of these things are interesting. Well, obviously Urantia is going to be fascinating to many, and it's going to attract people that way. However, there's all the other celestial beings, and there are plenty of beings that on their off time probably are engaged in educational pursuits and decide to come here for whatever the reason. You know, we're not the only place they decide to go, clearly, but this is obviously now a bigger attraction. What's fascinating to me is to consider, you know, that it's not inherent, you know, it's not, it's still valuable for a being that can get most of the information that must be available in the universe at various levels, you know, because the record keepers are the information that's available is just phenomenal. they still want to come and visit and check things out for themselves and see what's going on in a particular place. Nothing takes the place of an actual visit in some cases, in many mm-hmm. cases. And then mm-hmm. there's the fascinating things within paper 30 that would give us pause to consider what else could be happening. So we've got the celestial beings that have been revealed, various angelic orders, both the ones that are concerned with the ascension scheme and the six other major orders that have nothing to do with the mortal ascension scheme, but may be fascinating. I mean, these are people and they're fascinated about where they live and the unusual places within it, just as we will be, just as we are growing to be. So what always strikes me with the classification of beings is where they give us plenty of unrevealed beings. Well, some of the unrevealed beings that they tell us about, and you know, they tell us about unrevealed dual origin beings that are stationary orders. They tell us about unrevealed ascenders. Well, that's in the context of adjuster-fused mortals, sun-fused mortals, spirit-fused mortals. There's plenty of spirit-fused mortals that I'm sure come to visit. Translated midwares, I'm sure they come to visit, you know, other worlds where their fellow midwares are. But unrevealed ascenders, there are other ascenders that are not mortal ascenders. Oh. And on and on. You can, you know, there are unrevealed ascender, or unrevealed angels as well. I mean, unrevealed ascending angels that are different than the ones that have been revealed. Anyway, on and on and on.
Well, and so then there's that wonderful quote about some beings right here on the planet that are so close to us, and we could almost perceive them, but they can't tell us who they are. You remember which one
that's
I'm
right.
talking about?
Well, I do.
And that's
do,
so
yeah.
intriguing, isn't it?
Yeah.
My goodness, that just thrills me. I think, who are they talking about? And I've heard so many different speculations over the years. They're fairies, they're, you know, dolphins, they're, you know, some readers even think they're midwares, but then
they
go on to tell
about
us about
beings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where they speak about those beings are where they're talking about the secrets of Seraphington involving a threefold mystery, only one of which I may mention, the mystery of seraphic transport. So, okay, so there's three mysteries, only one of which they may mention, okay, seraphic transport. They say that that's pretty unusual. It's a secret locked up in the sacred sectors of Seraphington. I'm glossing over that, all right? The other mysteries of Seraphington pertain to the personal experiences of types of spirit servers as yet not revealed to mortals on Seraphington. So they're related to angels, but they're spirit servers that aren't revealed to us. And we refrain from discussing the secrets of such closely related beings because you can almost comprehend such near orders of existence. And it would be akin to betrayal of trust to present even our partial knowledge of such phenomena. That's 13.120, where they talk about
that.
That's
a great example of a secret that they're keeping.
Yeah.
Boy, that comment just fills me with wonder. I don't know about you
Doesn't
guys,
it?
But
well, it
oh,
makes you,
man.
It makes you wonder about fairies and leprechauns and all of the things that have entered the lore that are clearly not fairies, not leprechauns or whatever, but not elves. But what are they? We've been told about midwares. You told us about midwares.
So I don't think it could be midwares.
You can't tell us about these other ones?
Right.
Who else is there?
That's interesting. Yeah.
Chuck, do you know? Chuck, have they been visiting you?
Have you ever been visited by the wee people?
Not yet.
Yeah. Not yet. Not yet. Well, if I have, I don't know it, right? That's the thing. And maybe that's why it would be akin to a betrayal of trust. If they told us anything about them, then we would know how they function and operate, and we would be able to maybe thwart them somehow, you know, and that would not be good. That would not be good for us to thwart their efforts.
No, it wouldn't be good.
You know?
Yeah. Not for immature human beings
to
have that knowledge.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's a really classic example of it.
There's always the Maranta Cherubim, of course, who are quasi-material. Mm-hmm. And who knows what they're up to. But they apparently assist the secondary midwares, or completely different order, but have similar functional abilities.
Yeah.
You know, so they are here on your ranch.
That's a good point, but they are actually revealed. It's just fascinating. Again, the book is remarkable for what it tells us and discloses
what it doesn't tell,
but doesn't tell us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, those are all things, you know, I know you're saving up.
It doesn't want us to get locked into the idea here that the past people who have received revelations have done. And that is, okay, we've received a revelation, now this is it. Now, we should be beyond that. But in order to make sure we don't get there, they keep telling us, this is unrevealed to you. This is unrevealed. These beings are unrevealed. They keep telling us things like that, partly to suggest to our creative imagination or some of our philosophical speculation, but part of it also is to prepare us for whatever revelation comes down, you know, thousands of years from now. The next epical revelation can't be hundreds of years away. It's probably thousands, at least a couple of thousand years away, or maybe 1,000 at least. We can't be expecting revelation after revelation like kids in a candy store. You know, we need to work with what we've got. But the fact is, they also want to prepare the culture. What will happen with the Urantia book is, as this becomes established after hundreds of years, this will start to have its own mystique for some people. Maybe for many people, maybe for all people, I don't know. But that mystique that will surround it after it's been around 500 years or 1,000 years or 2,000 years, will it be intact? Will it be inviolate? And will it still say to people, you know, there are things that are unrevealed, and therefore prepare people for the next revelation? Well, that's the responsibility of everybody who comes now and after us to make sure that this revelation is available for others.
Yeah. And that was what was behind the Go Slow mandate, that it wouldn't be attacked and destroyed before it had a chance to gain root. And I always appreciated that, too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's a thought, and I know you guys will remember this, but in paper 13 it tells us all of the secrets. Not all of them, I mean, it tells us of the secrets of Divinington, the secrets of Sonorington, the secrets of Spiritington, the secrets of Vice Garrington, the secrets of Solitarington, and the secrets of Seraphington, the secrets of Ascendington, which is our personal, right? Those are our secrets because we're ascenders.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been intrigued by that. They all have secrets.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I marvel that that's not a bad word, that everybody has secrets. And as long as those secrets are, you know, strategic, they're withheld for a purpose, then they have value.
Mm-hmm.
That section has always thrilled me. Isn't there another quote that says, don't attempt a landing on Dominican or something?
I can't
remember now.
Yeah, no, there is. Always show regard for your superiors, show regard for your subordinates, and never attempt a landing on Dominican. That's the one charge to all high spiritual beings. Those are paradise-level beings and Havona-level beings.
Right.
Really. So there are no-nos there. And, you know, there are other no-nos. We'll never land on the worlds of the sun in Havona, you know, or not in Havona, but surrounding paradise, the paradise worlds of the sun. They are, apparently there's no personalities that ever go there. How about that? And we'll never go to nether paradise because evidently it's all energy. There's no persons on that level either. You know, you just have to imagine, what is it like at, you know, that part of peripheral paradise? Do they have a gate? Do they have a wall? How is paradise constructed at that point? You know, anyway, that's a rabbit hole. No.
Well, I gotta point out, Perry on the board just said, this is a really intriguing thought, Perry. Thank you for posting this. She says, I don't think there will be another epical revelation. This is a one-time rehabilitating aid to bring us up to a level where the magisterial son or some other contact personality can be appreciated. Wouldn't you think that a magisterial son is an epical revelation, though? I mean, wouldn't that qualify as one?
I think that's what Perry is meaning, actually. And, you know, this is not the only epical revelation. This is the fifth. You know, Michael was the fourth, you know, and Melchizedek the third. So if we receive a magisterial son next, or if Michael returns next, you know, or Melchizedek, you know, has some kind of bestowal, or a teacher's son comes out of order, you know, they're all bets are off because it's Michael's world, though he will do the next best, most reasonable thing. That will eventually be an epical revelation. And I knew you meant that, Perry. She just clarified.
She did.
On the
she
board
said
that
I
she meant
in
book
form.
Form.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree.
Yeah, 'cause you
I
can't,
absolutely agree with that.
You can't kill a book. And if we received, we needed a revelation now, but we couldn't receive a person, or they'd probably be killed at this point still too. That's part of the reason, I think. We can receive this better than something else. So,
Mo and I have done a lot of introductions to
points.
The Arantia book. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying, too. It's right. I agree with you. We won't get another one in book form, I don't think. But Mo always likes to tell people when we're introducing the Arantia book is that the reason they sent a book is when they saw what we did to the last ambassador they sent here, that they couldn't get any volunteers. It's funny. It strikes me as funny, but it's probably true. You know, it's like, ooh, I don't know. I don't want to go down there after what they did to the sovereign of the universe, which is, you know, it makes you sad, though, too, to think about. I've been thinking about that a lot lately, you know, that the universe, it'll be an icebreaker to be from Urantia in the universe, you know. But there also might be, you're from that world. Okay. That explains a lot. There might be some of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Some ew going on. But, you know, you never know. I mean, I often think that if we were to be transported right now to a world enlightened life, we would be absolutely naked in our imperfections. But actually, they'd probably be very interested in us, and they'd want to, you know? If they could perceive us, they'd probably have a lot to ask and a lot to learn, because we're all curious beings. Just as curious, they'd be just as curious about us as we would be about them, I'm sure. Probably more so. So I don't know if we have time to read High Commissioners. Chuck, you've been very quiet.
I think we do.
Are you ruminating?
I think we could at least, we could at least read it discuss. And if we need to revisit next week, that's fine.
Okay.
Well, we know, Marvin, when he comes back, he always wants to revisit things anyway. You know how that goes.
Yeah, that's true.
So.
Yeah. Well, who wants to read that one then, Section 5, High Commissioners?
Chuck, do you want to arm wrestle for it?
The workers are here.
Oh.
So.
Okay,
so
I'll go ahead and read
it. A bit noisy. So
I'll be glad to read it.
Hammer
I'll stay
in.
On mute.
Okay.
Well, we'll see. I don't know yet. Okay.
All right.
I'll stay on mute.
Nope.
Okay.
No problem. And let me just, let's see if it wants to pull up for me. My goodness gracious, this thing. I just love it when all of a sudden the computer decides, oh, I don't want to behave now. Just a moment. There we are. The High Commissioners. The High Commissioners are spirit-fused ascendant mortals. They are not adjuster-fused. You quite well understand about the universe ascension career of a mortal candidate for adjuster fusion. That being the high destiny and prospect for all Urantia mortals since the bestowal of Christ Michael. But this is not the exclusive destiny of all mortals in the pre-bestowal ages of worlds like yours. And there is another type of world whose inhabitants are never permanently indwelt by thought adjusters. Such mortals are never permanently joined in union with a mystery monitor of paradise bestowal. Nevertheless, the adjusters do transiently indwell them, serving as guides and patterns for the duration of the life in the flesh. During this temporary sojourn, they foster the evolution of an immortal soul, just as in those beings with whom they hope to fuse. But when the mortal race is run, they take eternal leave of the creatures of temporary association. Surviving souls of this order attain immortality by eternal fusion with an individualized fragment of the spirit of the local universe mother spirit. They are not a numerous group, at least not in Nevadon. On the mansion worlds, you will meet and fraternize with these spirit-fused mortals as they ascend the paradise path with you as far as Salvington, where they stop. Some of them may subsequently ascend to higher universe levels, but the majority will forever remain in the service of the local universe. As a class, they are not destined to attain paradise. Not being adjuster fused, they never become finaliters. But they do eventually become enrolled in the local universe core of perfection. They have in spirit obeyed the Father's command, be you perfect. After attaining the Nevadon core of perfection, spirit-fused ascenders may accept assignment as universe aides, this being one of the avenues of continuing experiential growth, which is open to them. Thus do they become candidates for commissions to the high service of interpreting the viewpoints of the evolving creatures of the material worlds to the celestial authorities of the local universe. The High Commissioners begin their service on the planets as race commissioners. In this capacity, they interpret the viewpoints and portray the needs of the various human races. They are supremely devoted to the welfare of the mortal races whose spokesmen they are, ever seeking to obtain for them mercy, justice, and fair treatment in all relationships with other peoples. Race commissioners function in an endless series of planetary crises and serve as the articulate expression of whole groups of struggling mortals. After long experience in problem solving on the inhabited worlds, these race commissioners are advanced to the higher levels of function, eventually attaining the status of high commissioners of and in the local universe. The last registration recorded slightly over 1.5 billion of these high commissioners in Nevadon. These beings are not finaliters, but they are ascendant beings of long experience and of great service to their native realm. We invariably find these commissioners in all the tribunals of justice, from the lowest to the highest. Not that they participate in the proceedings of justice, but they do act as friends of the court, advising the presiding magistrates respecting the antecedents, environment, and inherent nature of those concerned in the adjudication. High commissioners are attached to the various messenger corps of space and always to the ministering spirits of time. They are encountered on the programs of various universe assemblies, and these same mortal-wise commissioners are always attached to the missions of the sons of God to the worlds of space. Whenever fairness and justice require an understanding of how a contemplated policy or procedure would affect the evolutionary races of time, these commissioners are at hand to present their recommendations. They are always present to speak for those who cannot be present to speak for themselves. The worlds of the spirit-fused mortals, group of seven primary worlds and tributary satellites in the Salvington Circuit, are the exclusive possession of the spirit-fused mortals of Nevadon. Ascending adjuster-fused mortals are not concerned with these worlds except to enjoy many pleasant and profitable sojourns as the invited guests of the spirit-fused residents. Except for those few who attain Uversa and Paradise, these worlds are the permanent residents of the spirit-fused survivors. Such designed limitation of mortal ascent reacts to the good of the local universes by ensuring the retention of a permanent evolved population whose augmenting experience will continue to enhance the future stabilization and diversification of the local universe administration. These beings may not attain paradise, but they achieve an experiential wisdom in the mastery of Nevadon problems that utterly surpasses anything attained by the transient ascenders. And these surviving souls continue as unique combinations of the human and the divine, being increasingly able to unite the viewpoints of these two widely separated levels and to present such a dual viewpoint with ever-heightening wisdom.
Wow. So can you recap why a being would become a spirit fused? If I'm recalling right, non-breathers do. Is that correct? Non-breathers
yeah.
become spirit fused? And
yes,
is there another reason why? To me, that's intriguing in itself. What is it about breathing that would make us more of a candidate for adjuster fusion than non-breathing?
Well, it's more a matter of the radical adjustment to a non-breathing environment that they're doing. They not only don't breathe, they don't eat, they don't drink.
Right. Right.
You know, they take in.
They live underground.
Energy.
Essentially.
Well, yeah. We don't know. We don't. Some of it's underground. Some of it is in their protected, you know, shelters that have shunts and disintegrators and whatnot. There's all of that, but all of that contributes to a very radical adjustment to life that evidently makes it impossible for them to be permanently indwelt by thought adjusters and only.
Huh.
Only allow them to move forward as spirit-fused mortals. But the same is true,
yeah.
we're told, of the descendants of Andon and Fanta. They lamented that because of some of the backmating that occurred, at least that's how you could call it. I don't think they ever referred to it that way in the book itself, but the idea of they mated with some of their animal, you know, pre-human cousins and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
That those individuals, you know, degraded themselves sufficiently, and there were others that were primitive for other reasons probably, that never got to the point where they could entertain adjusters permanently in the early ages of Urantia. So there are spirit-fused mortals that came from Urantia, probably even some all the way up until the resurrection and Pentecost. There are probably some of those, though more and more would have been capable of adjuster fusion. But the universal bestowal of adjusters didn't happen until Pentecost. So all bets are off now. No, anyone who is indwelt on Urantia is destined to the core of the finality. You either choose to move forward with your adjuster or you don't. So, Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just read. Yeah. And I just read in paper 40, section 9, paragraph 1, it says, ascending spirit, these mortals, are not third source personalities. They are included in the Father's personality circuit, but they have fused with individualizations of the pre-mind spirit of the third source and center. Such spirit fusion never occurs during the span of natural life. It takes place only at the time of mortal reawakening in the Urantia existence on the mansion worlds. In the fusion experience, there is no overlapping. The will creature is either spirit-fused, son-fused, or father-fused. Those who are adjuster or father-fused are never spirit or son-fused. So that's, I searched spirit-fused and it only came up 3 times, and I know it comes up more than that, so it might be that there's a hyphen or something in it. But
there is a hyphen.
Spirit-fused
or spirit-fuser, you know.
Mm-hmm,
so if you put an asterisk after the S, you'll get more.
Okay,
spirit-fused, spirit-fuser, spirit-fusion, all of those flavors of spirit-fusion. Yeah.
And here it shows the section you just read. Thank you for that, Andre. It was really nicely read. Highlights again another pattern, and that is this pattern of having a permanent aspect, a permanent resident. You know, not unlike what the Midwayers do for Urantia. They become that continuity, that living history, you know, that is so invaluable. To putting together, to building a bridge between the spirit world and the material world. And it's like they're saying these beings do the same thing in the local universe. Would you say that's true? They become the permanent resident, in a sense, that they describe that in that last paragraph.
They're an ascendant.
They continue as unique.
Citizenship, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're dual,
you know, along
viewpoint,
with,
you know,
the cessation.
Right. I love that. It just is, to me, that's wisdom, you know. You have to honor the on all levels, the people or even the beings that hold that position of being that bridge, the living bridge. And, you know, we see that. We see that in politics especially. We see these people that, you know, work for the government and they do their best to be nonpartisan, and they hold that continuity from one administration to the next. None of them could function. If you had to fire the whole government in order to have a new administration, it would be an absolute disaster. So I've gotten to where I respect them more and more over the years and the role they play. Maybe it comes from having worked as the director of the fellowship. And so with all the different changing of the guards over the years, you know, the staff holds that continuity I never fully appreciated that until I did. And then it's like, oh, now I get it. Now I see what my predecessor, John Hales, was talking about. You know, I didn't fully understand it before, but, you know, after having served in his position, I fully understood it. I noticed, Andre, that Vaughn would like to come on and make a comment. We put Vaughn on?
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know how long he's had his hand up.
I don't know
Vaughn.
Either. I just noticed it.
Hello. I wanted
Hello.
To share with you about a wonderful movie I saw the night before last in the theater called Paul's Promise. It's a Christian movie. And
Paul's Promise.
It's very positive and also an opportunity to see the thinking of the people in Little Rock, Arkansas, back in the late 50s when their homes were being burnt, the protesting was going on, and the racism was great. I saw it in a big movie theater, in the multiplex, and it's new. And there's also other information about other movies that will be coming up in that venue. And so it's not out on the internet yet, I guess. That's all. I just wanted to share that. It's a very positive opportunity for experiential growth in the movie theater about the level of awareness that the makers of that movie had chosen to share. It was very well done.
Yay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. I just wanted to share that.
Thank you. Well, you know.
Thank you so much for all your efforts.
Oh, thank you, Vaughn. You were there for, you know, in those same efforts when we were talking earlier about standing there introducing people to the Urantia book in the 80s. I know you were
right.
in on a lot of that, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Okay. Yeah. That brings up. Thanks,
yeah.
Vaughn. Much love to you, brother.
Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, it brought up to what you said about racial was one of the most intriguing things about the section that Andre read. And
right.
how these high commissioners act on behalf of the various races at some level, and how important that must be. And I have to ask then, it left me with this question of some races suffer so much and have been, you know, especially on this world, have been decimated. And I just wonder, I want to throw out that question, why do you think that is, has been so prevalent on our world? Is it because we're in rebellion?
Well,
let
me make a little comment about this movie showing how the racists themselves suffer so much.
The racists?
Yeah.
The racists suffered. I see.
The individuals who were racists, their suffering was shown greatly. In the movie.
Maybe, you know, I've had that insight about people who torment other people, that they themselves are tormented. In their own
yes.
heart, in their own inner life, they're tormented, and that's why they torment others, because of their torment. Might be self-imposed, it might be caused by something else, it might be caused by society or for some other reason. And I had that insight myself as being the youngest female child with two older brothers who seemed to take delight in tormenting me. And the insight I had was that a lot of that was societal, brought on by societal norms that said that they had to be strong and they couldn't have any feminine inclinations. And my femininity made them uncomfortable then. And that was an insight that I came to as an adult. I mean, it took me quite a while to understand that. And my initial feeling was compassion for them, for the way they hurt, and for the unfairness that they were put under that made them, you know, do that, something like that, which certainly, knowing them, they didn't want to do that. But they were acting out, you know. So, yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to watch that movie, Vaughn. Thank you for that recommendation.
Watch it as soon as you can, and share it with everybody that you care to, appreciate it greatly, because it covered many aspects, and it spoke of speaking about society causing the little boy long decades earlier than the movie time, forsaking his neighbor, the black boy, forsaking black boy's friendship when the pressure from the other older black children threw rocks at the black boy and not defending him.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, when societal pressure causes us, and this is nothing new. I mean, Jesus himself addressed it in the second discourse when he said, you know, no one ever expected you to believe in a thing that's spiritually repugnant, you know, and yet, you know, or he said, my father doesn't expect you to believe in things that are spiritually repugnant. And yet, you know, many societal pressures do put that on children, and their initial feeling about certain beliefs is that they're repugnant, but they have to swallow their own, you know, inner guidance and their own heart, the guidance of their heart to be accepted by the group. And so, yeah, that's an interesting pressure.
Like what was mentioned earlier about the people behaving in the starving nations of North Africa.
In the what?
Starving,
I didn't hear
nations,
that last. Oh, in the starving nations, right.
North Africa,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Andre brought that up. What they have to do in order to survive, and what happens when survival gets so basic that it's either, you know, starve or eat. What people end up doing in order to survive, you know, at a very basic level.
Thank you.
Thought provoking. Well, thank you, Vaughn.
Thank you, Vaughn.
So, Andre, I think you were going to also answer that about the races and how, you know, that's an interesting. What's the end goal? Is amalgamation of the races always the end goal?
Yeah.
Would you say?
I think it's looked at as more or less inevitable that all human beings will eventually mix with each other. But it doesn't happen right away, and there is a certain natural antipathy in primitive human beings to essentially look at, you know, another race as other and therefore foreign or alien. And, you know, that's typical in primitive times. As we advance, we get closer and closer to being able to, you know, see the similarities. But on a normal world, there is also the element of the Adamites that are mixing first with these with all of the races, and therefore there is commonality among these peoples, and so that's like a middle step that is usually there. Well, we're going to have much less ability to do that, you know, on our world, because frankly there's been less of that kind of mixing that was available, and now that opportunity is gone. And so now they indicate we're going to have to solve our problems you know, with our own resources. And some of that means through scientific methods of looking at, you know, what is best for, you know, moving forward. I mean, it's a very complicated question, and because of our fraught social history, it becomes, you know, even difficult to speak too much about it. But clearly, one of the things that has been helpful in moving us toward knowing more about our human natures is the Human Genome Project, and being able to understand what our genetically caused diseases and what kinds of genetic maladies there are. So we've been able to look at that. We have yet to be able to see what some of the more positive traits are, and I think it's going to be a long time before it becomes socially acceptable to even look at it or talk
or about even talk
it because
about
of all the because of all the misuse of of those kinds of programs of quote unquote trying to better the human species that were done for the wrong reasons or were done with a view that it should be done by addressing one group of people or another.
Right. Or making us all homogenous and think the same way. Right.
Right.
Hold the same opinions. Right.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, we're almost out of time. And Chuck, you've been so quiet. Are you still, are the workmen still ticking away?
Oh, yeah. I've had to go talk to them a couple times.
Oh, have you? Okay.
I mean, just about the work, but. There was one other thing, we only got a couple minutes, that I thought was interesting, which is we have two different descriptions of spirit fusion. In one place, it's described eternal fusion with an individualized fragment of the spirit of the local universe mother spirit. And then in the other reference in paper 40, it's described, they say that they've fused with individualizations of the pre-mind spirit of the third source and center.
Right.
So, you know, putting both of those together, I mean, they're both talking about the same thing, presumably. I think it's interesting that the local universe mother spirit is able to provide that, which
that
kind of makes
me
sense.
Too.
If they're going to be at home in Nevadon, and Nevadon is her realm, then individualized fragment of the spirit of the local universe mother spirit. I don't know, that's hard to understand what that even means. But the idea that that can also be considered or thought of as a free mind spirit of the third source and center. I mean, we know that the third source and center and the universe mother spirit, they're the provision of mind comes through the, you know, the third person of the Trinity. And it's, you know, and then ultimately through the mother spirit, in our case, with the adjutant mind spirits. So an individuation of the pre-mind spirit of the third source and center is an intriguing notion.
Yeah, and that fragment of the mother spirit. Not
that
unlike
can
the
also
fragment.
Be thought
of,
So anyway, I just wanted to point that out. That's kind of a stereoscopic view on that idea, spirit fusion.
Well, hold that thought, because we can talk about that
next week.
we'll be doing the Celestial Overseers, and I just want to say quickly thank you to both of you. It was a wonderful study. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I look forward to Saturdays. And thank you to Isadora and Perry and Robert and Gina for listening on the board and commenting and sharing, and thank you, Vaughn. We appreciate you guys. We'll be back next week with Celestial Overseers. Until then, bye for now.
Bye for now.
Have a great week.
Much love to you guys.
You too.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.